The website, once again, is www.nchv.org. On the right-hand side, you'll see a link that says NCHV conference calls, and you'll be able to download the information there for the call today if you did not receive them. If you've got the materials via email earlier, it's the same material. You don't have to download it again.
Oh, okay. Great.
Okay, Kelly, if you want to unmute your line, hit star 6, we'll go ahead and start. Okay, Kelly, are you there? Kelly, if you can hear, you're going to unmute your line by hitting star 6. I apologize for that. We're under a new system here. So, Kelly, if you can hit star 7 to unmute your line, we'll go ahead and get started.
Donnie?
Yes.
Okay. So I was hitting star 6 over and over again. I was like, I'm not sure if I'm being...
They sent out new controls, and they're very different than what we just... So I do apologize.
No, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
But I do appreciate everyone's patience. I've got two different commands, and none of them are working. So I can operate real quickly. So I do appreciate that. For those of you who have just joined the call, this is the conference call, the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. Today we're going to be talking about developing permanent supportive housing. Kelly from the Coalition for Supportive Housing will be our presenter. He has provided some information on our website, and you can download that on there if you did not receive them. The website is www.nchv.org, and you can click on the conference call to download the materials. With that, I'll go ahead and hand it over to Kelly, and we'll start our call.
Great. Thanks, Melanie. Good afternoon, everyone. As Melanie stated, my name is Kelly Kent, and I'm with the Corporation for Supportive Housing, and I'm in our National Innovations and Research Unit and focus a good deal of my time on the issue of homeless veterans. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the employment services and permanent supportive housing for homeless vets. I believe you all have the materials sent out, the PowerPoint, as well as a handout, and I'll actually be providing some resources where you can find additional materials at the end of the presentation. So if folks want to follow along with the PowerPoint, I'll try and move through the PowerPoint fairly expeditiously so that we can try and have some time at the end for some group discussion if possible. So basically, I'll be focusing on providing just a brief overview of what supportive housing is, how it differs a little bit from more transitional models or the existing or historic way. way that the homeless system really helped homeless individuals with special needs. Really defining the population, providing a very brief overview of supportive housing models. We could spend a good deal more time and do probably an entire conference call just on that topic alone. And then really focus the majority of our time talking about developing employment services and some different model place-based employment. And then at the end, I'll provide some additional resources where you can find additional toolkits available on our website around employment-based services. So that can be a resource that you can download for free. So the Corporation for Supportive Housing is a national nonprofit and intermediary. We're also a community development financial institution that assists communities to increase the amount of permanent supportive housing in their communities to prevent and end homelessness. We've been in existence since 1991, and we largely focus our attention in three core areas of business, one being advocacy at the local, state, and federal level. Two, training and technical assistance for organizations developing housing for homeless populations with special needs. And three, pre-development lending for projects that project sponsors are developing. In terms of supportive housing, the traditional system, really functioned, and on slide five, it shows kind of a sample of what the traditional system really functioned as. You know, someone in homelessness kind of moving through the system, a real housing readiness model, going from shelter to transitional housing, and then eventually moving towards permanent housing. Supportive housing differs from this traditional system in that we believe that supportive housing is permanent, affordable housing combined with a range of supportive services that can help people with special needs live more stable and independent lives. It means that individuals can move directly into permanent supportive housing from homelessness, be provided wraparound services, and maintain housing stability. And there's a great deal of research that shows that for those with the most extensive service needs, permanent supportive housing is oftentimes the most effective intervention to provide housing stability, to prevent folks from cycling through emergency systems or transitional housing programs. When we talk about permanent supportive housing, there's really kind of three core components, both under housing and services, that we're referring to. One is that the housing is permanent, affordable, and independent. So this means that a tenant holds a lease. It's not programmatically based. So whereas transitional housing, the individual has only 24 months, up to 24 months in the program, the individual holds the same rights and responsibilities of tenancy that you or I would if we rented a unit in the private market. When we talk about affordable, we really try and target most of the units within permanent supportive housing are usually for those at 30% and below area median income. So folks that really do not have a large amount of monthly income. In terms of services, the services are flexible, really client-focused. So, you know, adapting the service model that you utilize or the services that the manager provides to the individual based on their individual needs. It's oftentimes voluntary. I know that, there are programs where that is more difficult, and we do serve programs where services are mandatory. But ideally, what the research has shown is that when services are voluntary and participation is not a condition of tenancy, individuals tend to really thrive and their housing stability rates are even higher. And the housing dependent is really focused on maintaining housing stability. We often say, and you'll hear me probably say this a couple times during the presentation, that services are oftentimes voluntary for the tenants, but they're mandatory for the staff. So it's really incumbent upon the staff in permanent supportive housing to make services irresistible for tenants and really engage tenants in a different way to help them see the importance of the services and why they would want to engage in those for their long-term housing stability. Excuse me. There are three core types of supportive housing that we're going to look at or models. One is a single site structure, which would be if you developed an apartment building where the entire building was for homeless veterans or their families. This would be largely developing a building from the ground up or doing a rehab of an existing structure. A scattered site model where you would use rent subsidies in the private market to rent apartments or homes in the larger community. And that often works in many communities where there is available rental stock. And then a third option is integrated housing where it's apartment buildings with mixed tenancies. So you say you have a 100-unit building, and you set 20 units aside for homeless veterans and their families. There's another 20 units that may be market rate housing. The remaining units might be senior housing or something of that nature. So there's a mix of populations, and only a certain percentage of the units are set aside for formerly homeless individuals. What we found in supportive housing is that services really make the difference. It's the combination of the housing and the services and providing those services in a wraparound fashion to the individuals in the housing that really guarantee their overall housing stability. On slide 9, you'll see a very brief list of the types of services that get provided in permanent supportive housing. Two types of services that I see in almost all of the permanent supportive housing for homeless veterans programs are both peer-to-peer mentoring programs as well as employment programming. However, in the additional handout that I sent over to Melanie, and I believe most of you have, is the supportive services planning worksheet. And this is just to provide, at a glance, a full range of services that could be provided in a menu within a supportive housing program or project. Some of these include kind of general supportive services, independent living skills, health and medical health services, mental health services, substance abuse services, vocational services, which we'll talk more about, services for families, really adapted for family members like childcare, daycare, things like that. So as you can see, there is a wide array of services that can be provided in housing in addition to employment services. So I think, what we talk about is that oftentimes having your organization identify what you do well and then identifying the other remaining types of services that you would like to extend to your tenants and possibly partnering with other organizations in the community to come in and assist in providing those services or develop memorandums of understanding to work together in providing those services. So we're going to spend a little time now just talking briefly about the target population, and I'll go through this very briefly. But permanent supportive housing is for those who are chronically homeless, really is those individuals who cycle through institutional and emergency settings, hospitals, jails, et cetera. And without the housing and the service combination, really have a history of cycling through programs and not being able to maintain housing stability. They won't be able to effectively engage in treatment and supportive services. So, again, it's that combination of the two that really makes this work. For homeless veterans, We estimate that based on challenge numbers that there's about 131,000 veterans who are homeless on any given night. Veterans account for nearly one-third of men who are homeless. 45% suffer from mental illness. Approximately 50% have substance abuse issues. And, you know, the statistic that I've always found really fascinating is that only 25% estimated or approximate have engaged in using VA services, but yet they estimate that a higher percentage, around 89%, have received an honorable discharge. So I think finding ways to engage veterans, and what I've often found in talking with mainstream permanent supportive housing providers that don't just serve veterans, but serve, you know, all populations, they say that oftentimes that they are serving veterans in their programs, projects, but you know, either their staff don't know how to access the VA system, or veterans aren't self-identifying. So, you know, one thing our organization is trying to do is to build linkages more between the VA system and the mainstream permanent supportive housing world, so that yeah, there is a larger knowledge base between the two. In terms of developing employment services, we're going to be on slide 15 right now if folks are following along. But again, referring back to the service menu or service planning worksheet, there, you know, really there are a vast array of services you could provide in housing, and really deciding which ones you want to actually offer is something that you as an organization need to take into consideration. Again, really thinking through what, you know, what your organization does really well. If you are really focused on employment services, you might want to try and partner with a community-based mental health provider to come in and do some of the mental health provision or case management, et cetera. Or if you're, say, an employment employment service provider, you may want to link up with an existing permanent supportive housing provider who has experience in property management and has staff that can be the primary case managers and link your staff to those types of programs. In terms of employment services and supportive housing, in one recent evaluation, which can be found actually on our website, is called Next Step Jobs, and I'll the last slide has our website address, and I'll give some more information on that at the end of the presentation. But in this evaluation, it was done in Jacksonville, Florida, and there were 565 supportive housing units that that were utilized for the study. It found that that permanent supportive housing and employment services and permanent supportive housing across the board really served all of those involved. The services cost about $3,700 per participant per year. But the cost of providing those services is really undercut by the benefits that both the participants as well as the public system see over time. Participants tend to earn more than 50% more than the comparison group that that was not in employment services or not engaged in employment services. We've seen that reliance on disability and public assistance declined significantly over time. And then economic benefits for the larger system in terms of workforce development, et cetera, is significant. In addition, what people tell us and what tenants tell us in supportive housing is that people living in supportive housing not only want a roof over their head, but they want to work, and then engaging in some kind of meaningful activity, is therapeutic. It provides social integration, increased independence, really helps them to create the largest amount of self-sufficiency possible. And more money really increases the tenant's long-term choices. Just in case folks are following along the presentation, we're on slide 18. But so when your organization is considering why or why not to create employment programming within your supportive housing projects, I think really thinking about how employment programming can really serve as a part of a holistic reintegration of the individual into your community. It really shifts the focus away from where tenants came from, you know, which was homelessness, to where they hopefully are going, and that being a better future. You know, what we found is that in many cases, the traditional mainstream workforce development system may not be equipped to really provide the individualized attention for your tenants. They usually need more than the traditional training that is provided in many mainstream workforce agencies. And while this is, you know, there's been quite a bit of work done through the Department of Labor with the demonstration projects like CHEETA, which was done several years ago, and that was a chronic homeless employment and training. And it was done over the course of 3 years in 5 communities. So there's significant work being placed in trying to, change things within mainstream workforce development to really adapt itself for those with special needs. But in some cases, it's necessary for supportive housing providers to work to adapt some of these programs for their tenants. As I was saying, that employment can serve as an excellent way to help motivate tenants and improve self-esteem and lead to self-sufficiency. On slide 19, it's just one example of an individual who went through a program called Thresholds, which was incorporated intensive wraparound support services, cross-agency collaboration between church leaders, case managers, peer support workers, employment counselors at one-stop centers, as well as culinary skills instructors. And as you'll see from the slide 19, Robert, you know, in 2000 was really struggling. And once he became a tenant at the Thresholds Project in 2003, through the intensive wraparound services that were being provided through many different partners, he really thrived and is now a certified chef making full benefits and fully employed. And this is a case study was pulled from the Rebuilding Lives report. All of this information that we're talking about today can actually be found within our employment toolkit, and I'll provide a website that folks can refer to download that for free off our website at the end of the call. So when we're talking about vocationalized employment, there's two examples. You know, on the left is what we would call vocationalized employment, really adapting the way that employment services are provided or offered to the tenants. It could be creating job assistance at intake into the supportive housing project as folks are leasing up and moving in. Really working with staff to develop jobs for tenants, whereas the traditional system is really much more focused and the onus is placed on the tenant to engage in more traditional systems, looking for work incentive information from SSA. They basically get there's no linkages necessarily between the housing project where the individual lives and the services they get on site and more traditional employment services, and the onus is really put on the tenant to navigate those systems. And as we stated, this oftentimes is not the most appropriate or effective way for those individuals with the most severe sets of needs to engage in meaningful employment opportunities. We're on slide 21 right now, if folks are following along. But what tenants can expect is that, more people are going to work and that the reliance on entitlements are going to decrease over time. What we found in many of our programs is that people that with mental illness or that have dual diagnosis tend to work more often in part-time employment than those without mental illness. However, that's not necessarily, always going to be the case. And that tenants tend to follow their own pathway to work. It's not a linear process. Providers need to be flexible. There may be several attempts for the individual to engage in employment, and that oftentimes it takes two or three attempts before the individual finds something that clicks and that that the provider needs to bring that thought process to the work and understanding that it may not be linear in nature. In terms of the goals of providing vocational services in supportive housing, these are fairly straightforward. Really helping individuals exceed, train and increase their employment goals or career objectives. Providing motivational support as staff on site and additional assistance to the individuals as they are trying to obtain and keep these jobs in the community. Looking to help individuals increase their tenant income so that they can help meet their own individual needs. And really the largest goal is to really help the individual reintegrate into the community so that they not only reach a level of self-sufficiency, but their highest level of self-sufficiency possible, but also so that they are, more fully integrated into the community and engaging and thriving in their community as fellow citizens. Some of the general types of support that could be provided are on slide 23, and these are just some examples. But providers could do job posting opportunities in places like the laundry room or other common areas, making staff available for tenants to work with them in the evenings or on weekends, not just when they're on the clock, providing funds to tenants for things such as work shoes or other work tools or work clothing, and trying to find some flexible funding to do that. Holding staff accountable for employment outcomes as well as housing stability. So really, ingraining that as a key component for your project staff in terms of the tenants. Not only maintaining their housing stability, but also how are they engaging in the employment services? How are what are the outcomes that are being achieved through those services? And then also developing and maintaining linkages with vocational rehabilitation agencies and one-stop centers, and then trying to really engage tenants from the get-go, as they come into and lease up and sign their lease and move into your project, really talking with them about what their work experiences in the past have been, what their interests are, and where they hope to go in their employment. We're going to talk about five different types of program models related to vocationalized employment. And this can be found on our website, and the link is at the bottom of the slide. But this includes job development, in-house employment and training, employment and training referral or interagency collaboration, enterprise development, and supportive services integration. And we're going to discuss each one of these in a little more depth. And as I stated, there is quite a bit of information in the materials on our website that folks can download for free. And we'll talk a little more about that in just a few minutes. So job development is the first model that we're going to look at. And this is really focused on working with existing local industries or corporate partnerships and trying to expand the amount of job options for your tenants in the general community. One example is the Marriott Pathways to Independence program. And this was started in 1990 in Atlanta and is now in more than 40 locations and is based in their corporate office in New York City. And it includes a six-week pre-employment training program that with life and occupational skills and really is focused on helping folks with special needs transition to careers in the hospitality industry. So, if you live in a location where there may be, a large corporate entity that, could or would be interested in developing, targeted training to meet the folks of not only those with special needs, but could also be very helpful to them as they try and develop new folks entering their company and to assist in the local industry and local employment opportunities. A second would be employment and training referral or interagency collaboration. And this is really focused on referring tenants to outside training and employment programs. So you wouldn't necessarily develop anything in-house. You would be working with existing resources out in the community. This requires a really deep commitment on the part of all partners to stay in contact throughout the process, not just up until the point where the individual finds employment. Largely because, as we stated, the success of individuals in permanent supportive housing is largely linked to the direct linkages between housing and services. So, ensuring that the partners involved and the various agencies participating really work closely with your staff on site within the project to make sure that the individual tenant is receiving the support they need as they kind of move through the process. And there's some examples there from New York. I believe Lenox Hill Neighborhood House is one of the key examples. Then a third option would be supportive services integration. And this is where you're really kind of taking a very holistic view of employment services. Engaging tenants at all levels of ability and work readiness. So this might include, providing GED or other educational assistance, looking at not only vocation, but also a full range of humanities work. One example is Deborah's Place here in Chicago, and it's called the Learning Center, and it's really an amazing program. It includes not only vocational training and GED, but a full range of humanities curriculum for the females that live in Deborah's Place. That includes things like theater, writing, et cetera. So, I think it's really an amazing program in that it kind of addresses the approach to vocation that, you really have to develop the individual's entire self in terms of, not only their work readiness, but also looking at their needs from a humanities perspective. A fourth program model is in-house employment and training. And so this is when you would really look to develop employment programming in-house, on-site within your supportive housing project. And this would be, it really demonstrates your own agency's commitment to doing employment services. As we talked about, it often incorporates peer support networks. But it also helps tenants gain both, the skills for the various jobs themselves, but also the soft skills in an affirming environment. So while they're working with staff, they're also developing those interpersonal skills. And it also demonstrates kind of a standing offer of work. If you're creating employment opportunities on site for individuals or within other projects that your organization may run, this oftentimes will serve as an incentive for individuals as they enter the employment program because they're seeing their peers working within your organization. Some examples is Housing Works in New York or Project Home in Philadelphia. And one of the just caveats I would say about this program is oftentimes if you're training tenants to, say, work in property management and assist by working the front desk at one of your developments, the one thing that, one caveat is to try and not have staff work within the same building that they live, only because it can tend to cause problems and put the individual staff person or tenant in a precarious situation sometimes of being a tenant and also working on site. So, and then the fifth model that we're looking at is called enterprise development. And, this is really creating employment and micro-enterprise. I think that it encourages business practices with nonprofits. I think that there are many examples around the country where this has been utilized, but some of the ones here are Rubicon Services and the bakery in Richmond, Virginia. And then Phoenix Recycling in New York City, but I've also seen programs in places like Seattle and San Francisco that did, have a cafe or a catering program. I know that there's a program in Los Angeles that has not only a catering program but also a convenience store that they run out of the first floor of one of their developments. So, I think that there is a number of opportunities that can be created to create employment opportunities as well as, some micro-enterprise for your organization. One resource for organizations that may be exploring this business idea that could be a free resource is local MBA programs, asking or engaging MBA students to help, work with you around an idea, write up a case study, do research assessment, make recommendations, and they can incorporate it into their studies, and it can be a free resource to you to develop some of the background materials you would need to try and get one of these micro-enterprises off the ground. But whatever the model that you select in as you put together your employment programs, There are some kind of key things that we've seen across the board that really make these programs successful, and one being accessibility. Having the employment programming on site or close by makes the opportunities for tenants to engage in these services that much easier. I think inclusiveness, working with any tenant at whatever stage of job readiness that they're at to provide some type of employment assistance and training, trying to be proactive, really looking at everything from GED training up through longer-term employment. And then flexibility, really, as I stated, having the flexibility to adapt to the needs of your tenants, recognizing that this may not be a linear process for many of them, and working on those soft skills, interpersonal skills, that are going to really benefit them in the long run in helping to engage these various employment systems initially get these positions of employment and then to maintain those positions over time. In addition, having a standing offer of work, programs tend to work better when folks see that as participants, they know that they are going to have a defined opportunity at the end of the training, whether that be an internship, jobs on site or outside of your development itself, but having some kind of tangible goal that they can see the benefits of entering the program. Making sure that the services are coordinated and integrated into the dialogue and discussion that your staff has with tenants on a day-in, day-out basis. Like I said, trying to engage folks the minute that they are coming through intake and moving into their unit, really talking about employment services and how your organization, whatever model you choose to use, and trying to engage those folks in dialogue around that as early on as possible. Emphasizing high-quality long-term employment, this really requires that your organization work intensively with clients and employers, as we talked about, especially if you're working with agencies out in the community that are not going to be directly linked to your project. It's going to be really important that you not only work with them up to the time of placement in a new position, but really working with them throughout that process, checking in with them periodically, and then after job placement, not only to hopefully, one, create additional job opportunities with that employer through that agency, but also to assess what's going well on a regular basis with the tenants that they're already serving. And then both links to public and private sector jobs. Looking at, as we talked about, major corporations, building new job opportunities, leveraging resources, and really kind of looking at things that may be innovative and kind of outside the box, because I think that we're seeing new and innovative ways to serve those with special needs on a continued basis, and I think that being open to that is really important. In terms of outcomes, thinking about housing stability for the individual, increasing their self-sufficiency, increasing their earned income, I think these are all things that, in terms of client outcomes, you really want to consider. Of course, your various funders may have their own funding requirements, and so being conscious of those as you look at your outcomes. And then in terms of housing retention, I think ultimately, any permanent supportive housing provider is really looking, their number one goal is to keep these individuals housed, because in many cases, these are folks who have histories of cycling in and out of programs. So really working with them, trying to provide the most adaptable services possible so as to keep that individual housed and thriving. Just in closing, before we kind of open it up for some discussion, because I think that you all could probably share some pretty good examples of work going on in your various locations with each other and learn quite a bit, as much or more as you're getting from myself in the presentation. Our website at www.csh.org/employment-toolkit. There is an entire employment toolkit that we've put together over the past year. And the last slide is under additional employment resources. Slide 32 has a direct link to that. Or you can go to www.csh.org under the heading resources and click on employment toolkit. This includes tools that you can use for tenants around outreach and engagement, a vocational assessment and career planning. It also includes tools to build staffing capacity, talking about building your team, workforce resources and community partners, and finding jobs and advancing careers. And then a third area, really focused on tools to use with employers. And this really focuses on the negotiation process with employers, job development, and employment specialists, you know, kind of a guide for your staff, financial incentives to hiring tenants for supportive housing, et cetera. So there's a large wealth of information within the employment toolkit, and I strongly encourage folks that are considering doing any kind of employment programming for their veterans project to take a look at it. I think it would be a really great ongoing resource for you. But with that, I will turn it back over to Melanie, and maybe we can open it up for some discussion or some questions.
Sure. Thank you very much, Kelly. If you do have a question or comment, to unmute your line, hit *7, and Kelly can answer any questions or take any comments that people may have on the call. *7 to unmute your line.
Kelly, this is Rick.
Yes.
As I said in New Jersey, one of the keys in our approach to this is the integration of nationally accredited Veterans Service Officers. And what we have suggested is that the local Veterans Service organizations, that would be Vietnam Vets, in my case, the VFW, American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, Paralyzed Veterans, whatever, participate in some way the provision of this nationally accredited Veterans Service Officer. And the VSO, this VSO should be on-site. But this, one of the things that we're trying to do is to reintegrate the local veteran community with these homeless veterans. As you know, a sense of camaraderie is one of the things that lots of homeless veterans talk about that they've never been able to recapture, particularly combat veterans. And we think that trying to get the local veteran service organizations to be engaged on an ongoing basis, either through events on the site, training, job opportunities, whatever, really brings these disenfranchised veterans back into the fold. So the other thing is a nationally accredited VSO would immediately deal with the problem of the 20% not using VA services, because their whole job and their training and their accreditation is based on the ability to coach or to assist veterans to what we call connect or be connected to VA. So you have a whole range of voc rehab services. You, of course, have the new GI Bill. You have a full range of medical and mental health services. That's within the traditional VA program, but then outside of that, within veterans centers, or vet centers as they're called, and that's only for combat veterans. And the interesting thing is it's combat veterans and their families. and their family. So if you have a combat veteran who's homeless, who has a family, they're having problems in the vet center, they can provide counseling not only for that vet, but also for their families and children in those families who may be having problems.
I think that sounds like a really interesting model. Maybe if you could provide your contact information to either to Melanie and she can, you know, place that somewhere, or if you're comfortable giving that out, you know, so that if folks have questions or would like to have an ongoing dialogue about with
sure, it's very simple. It's just rdavidge, it's rdavidge at CY, that's Charlie Yankee, Alaska, spelled out, .com. So rdavidge@cyalaska.com.
Okay, great. Another question or comment?
The other thing I wanted to mention is there's a program within the VA called the Veteran Industries.
That's cool.
That is a program that really does most of what you're talking about at all levels and a very, very successful program. But you have to be pretty clean and sober and be committed to get into that program. But once you do, that program is very successful because they have contracts with local employers specifically committed to this, and it's a very well-established, successful program. Thank you.
Great.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm here. This is Eric Voorhees, Roark Sullivan here in West Virginia. I know some of the problems we have a lot of times as far as tenancy goes is offender status. Do you guys have that problem there in Chicago as far as landlords and the people around not either wanting them there, or once the landlord finds it, they don't want to accept them? Do you guys have any type of program or cutting-edge model in order to kind of fix that issue? Because that can be a big issue once they get into the process of finding a place to get all excited. Then when they sit down with a landlord and they, "Oh, you're an offender, I'm sorry, we don't take them. We got this person here with the family and kids and that one," and it's been it could be an issue. Do you guys, have you been approaching that?
Sure. No, absolutely. Basically, there's actually quite a bit of leniency that local public housing authorities have around serving folks with criminal backgrounds. things that federally they are mandated to preclude folks for is manufacturing methamphetamine within public housing.
You were talking about sex offender status, right?
Right, or sex offender status.
Okay, because I know our Charleston Housing Authority here in Charleston, West Virginia, will not take sex offenders.
Right, and that is federally mandated. But a lot of housing authorities end up making the programs even more stringent. And so there is, we've actually done a summary of, what is actually eligible under public housing in serving reentry populations, and I can email that to Melanie, and she can post that on the website as well, if you're interested. But in terms of HUD-VASH, it's even more open-ended than standard Section 8 housing choice vouchers. It basically only has, so say your housing authority locally, won't serve anyone with a criminal history, just as an example, because they have such a long waiting list, they can do that and still serve a large number of people. HUD-VASH, which is, Section 8-like voucher that is targeted for homeless veterans, the only two things are those federal mandates of sex offenders or those that manufactured methamphetamine. So it's much more open than the standard Section 8 housing choice voucher that may be made more stringent based on local demands or needs.
Right. Well, that's good. But I'm talking about the landlord, because ultimately it's up to the landlord whether to take them or not. Do you guys have anything of, as far as like getting the word out to landlords and trying to foster relationships with landlords to be able to let these people live in their housing areas with the status?
Sure. I think that it's a lot about marketing and how your staff work with the tenants. Oftentimes I think it's very similar kind of discussions that housing authorities often have with Section 8 tenants as they are looking to approach landlords in the private market. and how they market themselves, talking about the program, and especially around permanent supportive housing. If you're trying to do scattered site, I would strongly encourage that your staff really work with the tenants as they are going out looking for units, helping them market themselves to landlords.
Okay.
Because oftentimes, especially folks, you know, with severe service, you know, with significant service needs, you know, that's asking them a lot, you know, to put themselves in a position to go out and negotiate a lease with a landlord and try and, you know, market themselves appropriately to that land. So, you know, really possibly having your staff go with them to talk about your program, you know, how it's helping these individuals, what the benefits are to the landlord in terms of having guaranteed monthly rental subsidy coming in, having the linkage to your service staff that they can call if they're a problem. You know, those types of things.
That sounds great. Well, too bad you're in Chicago, my friend. Now, I'd love you to come down here to my place here in West Virginia because based on the handout, I work for a place called Rourke Sullivan Veteran Services, and based on your handout, we basically do everything that you're talking about.
Oh, great.
We have the wraparound services. I think I brought one veteran. I did some outreach, and within 2 days, I had him a job. We've got AmeriCorps here. We do the, and I have seen this work wonders. We had one veteran come in. He said, I got more accomplished with you in 2 hours than I did 2 months in Texas.
Oh, wow.
So I've seen it work, and believe me, it's very rewarding and refreshing and exciting, actually.
Great. Well, I strongly encourage you to take a look at the employment toolkit on our website. Like I said, you can download it for free. I think it would have a lot of really good ongoing resources for your staff. It sounds like you've got a great program going on there, but as you kind of do ongoing capacity building with your staff and kind of looking at ways that they can kind of tweak the work that they're doing, I think that there's a lot of really great resources that you can utilize there.
Right. Yeah, I think that what we're doing here is it's really going to be wonderful because I know a lot of places around that offer services only want to offer to combat veterans. And a lot of these guys, like you said, they're not combat vets. That was really good information on the percentages, especially with the percentage of honorable discharges. And it's really eye-opening, you know. So, I'm a first-time veteran myself for 21 years, and I never even thought about that. When I saw that percentage, it's like, wow, you know.
Yeah, and I think that even for those that have bad paper, I think, you know, in many communities there are local legal clinics or, you know, nonprofit legal providers who you can work with and try and set up some kind of memorandum of understanding, have them come in and work with your tenants to try and get upgraded status. For individuals, it's a lengthy process, but I think it's worth it if you can try and get folks, connected with the system.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Kelly, I have a question. I have some properties in two locations in Louisiana and Virginia.
Yes, sir.
As a means of trying to begin to meet the needs of the people in those two communities where I serve as a bishop in a church organization, I'm the novice here. I'm somewhat new. And I'm wondering if there are any turnkey systems. I've got one place down in Louisiana in the New Orleans area, and I've got housing for about 150 to 100 people in a campus-style environment with the opportunity to create a restaurant on the property with culinary arts service, with waiter service training, along with an IT, what we call an incubation center, where we can, begin to teach people some really, really good skills that can create some tie-in to being marketable, you know, and if not in the New Orleans area, you know, whatever area we can link them to these various jobs. My problem is I don't believe I have to create a from-the-scratch program. I'm looking for a transitional in this model that you have on page 5. I'm more concerned with the transition shelter into the second stage up to 2 years and just create a partnership link with those areas in those communities that can do permanent housing. And I'm looking for a system, at least for the housing, the programs. We do a life care program. We call it 7 points of life, where you can deal with medical issues, legal issues, vocational training. We deal with economic issues, with money management, and, you know, doing things that will begin to, once they get their jobs, you know, create some type of management for self-sufficiency. My biggest problem in this initial start is I know there is a system out there for the day-to-day kinds of things that needs to be in place for policy and procedure. I've got a pool of staffing that I can pull from. I just don't know if I need to take the time to try and build my own system, or is there a system out there that I can, you know, that I can receive and begin to, even if I have had to customize it somewhat, to what we need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I would suggest that if you, you know, as I said, trying to do what you do well, you know, and so it sounds like you have some really great ideas around the employment programming and kind of micro-enterprise. And so I think trying to start talking to see if there are with folks that do permanent supportive housing in your communities. And we don't have offices in either of the locations you mentioned, so I'm not familiar with any providers, although I do know that Volunteers of America have some permanent supportive housing in New Orleans. You know, trying to work with providers in your community to link up to housing possibly, and see if there are ways that you can adapt a program, and maybe, you know, partner with some existing organizations.
Mm-hmm. Now I understand the partnering concept. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for, because what I'm finding is the permanent housing is the end game, but there are a lot of people that are just in situations where, you know, they're not even ready for permanent housing. They need to be in these types of transitional shelter, second stage, you know, two-year plan programs whereby people are constantly working with them to get them ready. I mean, and if in 6 months they're ready for permanent housing, yeah, we want to get them there. But, you know,
right,
just to kind of throw people in permanent housing, you know, there's also a thing they're doing, housing first. And
right, and that's what we would consider permanent supportive housing.
Exactly right. But what we're looking at, and what I'm finding in the two areas where we're looking to get this started based on a lot of our research, we're finding that this 2 year, there's a lot of 30-day shelters that, you know, does what it does. But they're not that program that these people can get in from 0 to 2 years, you know, 24 months, 18 months, that can really work with them and almost repackage their entire lives. There are not that many places where these people can find that type of housing or shelter, and that's what we want to provide. And when they're ready for permanent housing, we've got a pool that we can work with to try and move them into permanent housing, whether it's after 3 months, 6 months,
sure,
12 months, or whatever.
Well, I would suggest that you possibly talk with Melanie a little more, and she might be able to connect you with some transitional resources. We only focus on permanent housing,
okay,
so I'm not as familiar with that.
Kelly, if I could,
hold on just
1 second, okay? Kelly, if I could have you give out your contact information, and then we'll take one more question from the lady that just started, because I know it's time here. So, Kelly, if you could share your
sure
information.
Sure. It's in the presentation as well, but my email is Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, .Kent, K-E-N-T, at C-S-H, C as in cat, S as in Sam, H as in house, .org, or by phone at 312-332-6690, extension 17.
Okay, and then who?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
This is Dr. Thornton in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I wanted to speak to the bishop. I did not get his last name.
Williams. I was just out there in that area on yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm down in New Orleans right now. We're speaking.
Okay. All right. Last year we had a conference dealing with the homeless veterans housing issues in Baton Rouge, And as a result of that, we developed a contact list of those that were doing programs. One of our objectives were to identify model programs that can be replicated. And I think that's what I'm hearing you ask for. We could probably talk later because I know the time is well spent, but I just wanted to exchange the information that I might be able to give you some direction in that area.
Doctor, can you give us your contact information?
Sure. It's Marilyn Thornton. And the address is, it's Heritage International Ministries, and I am in the ministry as well. The address is 4520 Sherwood Forest Boulevard, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. 70816. Telephone is 225-603-9120.
Thank you.
Email.
I'm sorry, what was that?
The email is heritage I-M, H-E-R-I-T-A-G-E-I-M, at AOL.com.
Can you say that again?
H-E-R-I-T-A-G-E-I-M.
M or N?
M or N?
M, M. As, yeah, as in many. M.
Okay.
At AOL.com.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Is there anybody we can get the bishop's information as well?
Yes. It's C-I-O-A, Charlie Oscar Indigo Apple.
C-I-R-A.
I'm sorry. Yeah. C-I-O-A.
C-I-O-A.
That's correct. At cox.net.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank everybody for their time. We're a little after 3 o'clock, and we originally had scheduled a call for an hour, so I want to be cognizant, especially of Kelly's time. If you do have questions, you can either contact NCHP or Kelly. We will be posting the audio from the call, so if you'd like to listen in or if you missed a portion of the call, we will be doing that probably later next week. But we thank everyone for their time, and please let us know if you do have any questions. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.